the theme of this was a journey of someone who came from out of state to venture into law enforcement in Alaska.
The Fairbanks City Council okays a reality TV show about the city's police force. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, support for the Stand for Salmon ballot initiative at a Bethel hearing.
Since 2010, we've seen our runs really, really diminish.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Tomorrow is the big hearing in the U.S. Senate where Christine Blasey Ford is expected to testify about the drunken attack, she says, Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh inflicted on her when they were in high school. The confirmation vote in the full Senate is likely to turn on two Republican votes, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and our own Senator Lisa Murkowski. Let's hear from Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin, who has been talking to Murkowski all week. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Casey.
Liz, the left has been very vocal urging Murkowski to vote no on Kavanaugh. Has she given any signs that she might buck her party and vote against him?
Not that I've seen. Yesterday, she seemed for a minute to be calling for the FBI to investigate, and that had the anti-Kavanaugh crowd celebrating. Murkowski later clarified that she thinks all the allegations should be investigated, but by the Judiciary Committee. And that disappointed the left and had conservatives super happy.
How is Murkowski handling the pressure?
She seems to be in good spirits mostly. Around the Senate, she's been answering reporters' questions, maybe not to their satisfaction, because everyone is really looking for clues as to how she'll vote, and she is just not supplying any. There was one moment where it was clear she had just, had it.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I have some tape to play for you. A group of reporters had jumped onto her train car.
This is the train that runs under the Capitol?
Right, between the Capitol and the Senate office buildings. An MSNBC reporter asked her kind of a big picture question. It was whether we're at a turning point in history and whether that's a factor in her decision. And Murkowski answered that. And then a Bloomberg reporter asked her a really pointed question about Kavanaugh and Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion case.
What's your level of confidence that he would not try to dramatically shrink it?
And she kind of deflated and took this really long pause.
I'm just like transferring from your question to your question.
It's a very different question.
It is a very different question. And you know what? I think I'm done answering the questions for right now. Is that okay?
Sure.
Liz, was she mad?
No, it was more like a sudden loss of cabin pressure. But the reporters switched to just chatting with her, and she rallied to answer a few more questions.
So what's her answer about whether this Me Too moment puts us at a turning point in history?
Oh, she says we are having a cultural moment. The discussion about Kavanaugh, she says, is still about whether he's qualified, but here's what she told me.
It's now a greater dialogue, a national conversation about women that have become victims and their ability to tell their story.
Is Murkowski saying that's unfair to Kavanaugh?
She says there's a lot that's unfair here to him and to the women accusing him. She says that's just where we are, but she clearly doesn't like where we are.
Have you gotten much of a sense of how she's feeling about this vote or just feeling about all of this?
Not really. She is keeping her cards close to her vest, but I did ask her a personal question.
A lot of American women are saying that they've had Me Too moments, and I'm wondering if you have.
Yes.
And Casey, that is about all she wanted to say about that.
Okay, thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
That was Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin. A reality TV show featuring Fairbanks police was given the go-ahead by the city council Monday night. Mayor Jim Matherly will contract with New York-based Engel Entertainment to produce the program. KUAC's Robin reports.
Engel Entertainment approached the police department in the spring and sent a TV crew to Fairbanks for a visit. While here, they shot enough video to produce a short recruitment piece, which will be released to the public in about a week. Police Chief Eric Jukes says the company wants to make a television series about cops in Fairbanks.
The goal of this was not a traditional cops-type TV show where they just ride along and see what we do. The theme of this was a journey of someone who came from out of state to venture into law enforcement in Alaska.
Negotiations for a TV show, as well as the deadline to sign the contract, was a surprise to some on the council who saw it only recently. The contract language had been reviewed and changed by City Attorney Paul Ewers, who negotiated with the company, deleting some contract clauses and adding others.
I just want to make it clear that the contract you have in front of you doesn't have all of the changes that we proposed. And there are some that they insisted on and insisted that it must be signed tomorrow. So this is a take-it-or-leave-it provision.
Council member June Rogers did not like the time pressure of such a tight deadline.
I don't see where it's wise of us to succumb to that kind of pressure, sign the contract or it's gone tomorrow. It just doesn't seem to be fair play. If they're giving us that kind of an ultimatum, I don't feel comfortable with that.
Ewers wrote in a clause giving the police department authority to review the TV show episodes for objectionable material that might embarrass the department or the city. That was enough to convince other council members. Rogers voted against it, but the resolution was approved. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
A team appointed by Governor Bill Walker collaborated all summer to produce a comprehensive policy to address climate change. Their directive was to act bold, and today the group formally handed over that plan. But the work has only just started. It will be up to state agencies and elected officials to prioritize what's there. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
The state of Alaska recognizes that climate change is happening. And rather than wait around for outside help, the 37-page document outlines the prospect of local solutions to mitigate the damage. Set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Invest in a diverse economy less reliant on fossil fuels. Educate the public about the impacts of warming. That's just a slice of the recommendations. At the press conference in Anchorage, Governor Walker acknowledged there have been cutbacks to climate change programs at the federal level.
There has been a change in that regard, but that doesn't change. You know, we don't change what we do because somebody else changes what they do. So that didn't change, and if anything, it perhaps might have escalated a bit.
The Walker administration did go ahead and greenlight dozens of the team's suggestions spread out across various state agencies. Most of that focuses on developing a framework to address the climate change challenges that are already here and the ones that are still to come. The Climate Action Plan also includes the possibility of Alaska supporting some kind of national carbon pricing legislation while also investigating a state carbon tax. When asked about that, Governor Walker wouldn't commit to endorsing it.
I have said, and I remain, that I'm not interested in anything that's going to raise the increase the cost of energy to Alaskans.
Walker said continuing to utilize the Climate Action Leadership Team, comprised of stakeholders around the state, was important. And he was confident no matter what happens in the November election, whoever was in charge would see the benefit of continuing that work. The team is still appointed for the next 2 years, but that could be changed by an administrative order from a governor. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a longtime climatologist and studier of climate change is retiring this week.
Going forward, as Alaskans make decisions about our future, that context is very important.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kodiak Aleutians Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting October 15th and 16th starting at 9 a.m. at the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association Conference Room in Anchorage. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Alaska state officials hosted a public meeting on a controversial salmon habitat ballot initiative in Bethel yesterday. The initiative would toughen the permitting process for projects built on salmon habitat and could hinder the development of the proposed Donlin Mine, which could be one of the biggest gold mines in the world built in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Christy Schallenberger with Alaska's Energy Desk reports that, unlike Anchorage, where the crowd was overwhelmingly against the measure, the crowd in Bethel was mostly for it.
Of the 15 people testifying about the Salmon Habitat Ballot Initiative in Bethel, only two were against it. Alex Nick was in the minority. He has lived in Bethel for 20 years after moving from the village of Russian Mission. He's ambivalent about the measure's impact on the Donlin Mine, but he does worry about the consequences for smaller projects in the region.
Because the fact that in this day and age, there's salmon almost in every drainage, and the permit system will not do good for the area, and it might expand to harvest the fisheries.
The rest of the crowd, however, testified for it. Mary Peltola is the executive director of the Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission. But on Tuesday, she only spoke for herself, a subsistence fisherwoman.
Since 2010, we've seen our runs really, really diminish.
Peltola says that the Salmon Habitat Ballot Initiative will not bring back the salmon, but it would make sure that there isn't any more stress on the fish from man-made projects. Representatives from other villages, like Akiak and Gweeflik, also testified in favor of the initiative, and so did one of the founders of a local working group that opposes the Donlin Mine. Most people in the crowd support the ballot measure because of its salmon protections. For many of them, salmon harvested on the river is a huge part of their diet. A representative from Stand for Alaska, the group that opposes the ballot measure, also testified. The group's chairman, Marliana Hall, says the ballot initiative is too vague and too broad.
In the Yukon-Kuskokwim area, the lack of infrastructure is a reality, and this ballot measure will only hinder building or improving roads and other much-needed projects here and around the state.
Donlin Gold, the company trying to develop the mine, has repeatedly said that the measure would hurt the project. The company is one of Stand for Alaska's biggest supporters. Donlin Gold has contributed $1.2 million to fight the Salmon Habitat Ballot Initiative. The Chelista Regional Native Corporation, which owns the subsurface rights to the mine, also supports Stand for Alaska. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott presided over the meeting Tuesday. He told KYUK that he's neutral on the initiative, but Governor Bill Walker, who is up for re-election with Malott, has expressed concerns with the ballot measure. The state is holding 9 public hearings throughout Alaska about the Salmon Habitat Ballot Initiative. The final one will be a teleconference on October 13th, when any Alaskan who couldn't make it to the public hearings can have a say. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
The State Department of Education will pick Alaska's Teacher of the Year next month. This week, we'll have profiles of each of the 5 finalists from across the state. Steve Hall is a math and science teacher in the high school in the town of Houston. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on Hall's style of teaching, which emphasizes hands-on learning.
Growing up in small-town Wisconsin, Steve Hall joked that one of the few ways to apply science in the area was to be a veterinarian working with dairy farmers. His passion for science was always a little different.
I just was really good at it and enjoyed it a lot. I've got a couple uncles that were, if you will, rocket scientists for 3M. And so I think I just got predisposed to that kind of field.
Hall says he found his calling as a teacher when he was in the Army, where he learned just how valuable effective teaching could be.
There was a grenade course, safety course, that was being taught by a sergeant, and he forgot to mention the secondary safety pin. And so he got dropped for push-ups, and I'm like, if I ever have to teach something like that, I'm going to have a diagram or something. And so sure enough, I had to teach that course, and I had my diagram, and really enjoyed that.
After his service, Hall went to college for his teaching degree and taught for 5 years near his hometown. But after budget and staffing cuts, he started looking for a job somewhere else. His wife's sisters had settled down in Houston, Alaska, and suggested he apply for jobs there. He says when he got to Houston in 2003, he knew it was the place for him.
Oh, I loved it. The hunting, the fishing. You know, I said to my mother-in-law, oh, I'm home now.
When Hall first arrived in the Valley, he taught at Palmer Junior High, but was soon hired at the brand new Houston High School. The Department of Education highlighted Hall's extensive use of labs in his lessons as one of the reasons he was selected as a Teacher of the Year nominee. Hall says these activities help his students see where chemistry fits into their everyday lives.
We talk about, well, what things are going around the house. So if you're mixing oil and gas and you got to go 50-50, well, why do they mix? So you can talk about solubility of different liquids, same with antifreeze, stuff like that. And we also make ice cream so we can make it fun. Food science.
Hall is also a strong advocate for making sure every student in his classes is actively involved in the coursework. He teaches kids at a variety of levels, from his beginner classes to his advanced placement courses, and he pushes all of them to work to their potential.
What I'll do is when we do an activity, it's getting all the kids to participate, to learn it. And I'm like, you're not walking through that door till you know X, Y, Z. And then once they see that success and they keep working at it till they can understand it, and then you get the application.
Hall has been teaching for over 20 years. So long, in fact, that a former student of his now teaches biology at Houston High.
Yeah, no, it's good. You know, it makes me feel a little old, but that's all right.
Between his work with the recently started AP Chemistry class to his technology-infused inquiry labs, Hall says he's happy when his students go out into the world contributing to society and understanding the importance of science in everyday life. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The Homer City Council is contemplating a ban on thin, single-use plastic bags. The move would follow other communities that have passed similar ordinances. But this isn't the first time Homer has dabbled with the issue, and it's setting up yet another contentious debate over the role of city government there. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more.
The bag ban that was introduced Monday is largely the same ordinance city council members passed back in 2012. The ban would prohibit retailers from providing plastic bags thinner than 2.25 mils, which supporters argue would incentivize store owners to either eliminate plastic bags entirely or provide thicker bags that can be reused. However, the ordinance does provide retailers with a list of exceptions, such as bags for frozen foods or fresh produce. The original ban stayed on the books for less than a year, and a citizens' initiative later repealed the ordinance. Former Homer resident Justin Arnold led that charge and reminded current council members, all of which are serving their first terms, that voters spoke on the issue back in 2013.
I'm hoping it doesn't go farther than tonight. I don't really want to spend the time to do another repeal. I've moved out of the city. I'm living in Anchor Point now, but I still own property in town and can move right back in to do it.
The initiative he led argued that protecting the environment is not the city council's role, an argument Homer residents are familiar with. Similar disagreements about the purpose of the council led to a contentious attempt to recall three city council members in 2017 and a clash over a mayoral proclamation declaring June Pride Month earlier this year. Some council members agreed that voters had already settled the issue. Here's Councilmember Tom Strusis.
The citizens overturned the plastic bag ban by a substantial margin, a huge margin, 56% to 44%. Many people would deem that as a mandate.
Councilmember Carolyn Venuti sponsored the ordinance, and she acknowledges the results of the 2013 referendum. Venuti is largely concerned about a growing amount of research on microplastics working their way into seafood. She argued that waiting another year to let voters weigh in would amount to waiting on the sidelines as other communities take action.
But I'm doing this because I think the timing is right now. And I think we've been educated enough, and we've seen enough damage.
The council did introduce the ordinance in a 4-2 vote, and it also voted to hold two public hearings on the ordinance, the first of which will be on October 8th. The council is also set to hold the second hearing and vote on the measure at its meeting on October 22nd. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message is sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Some 6,000 military personnel from Fort Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson will deploy next week to the Fort Greely area for a big 2-week field training exercise to test the Stryker Brigade's combat readiness. And while they're training on the ground, the Air Force will launch its latest round of Red Flag aerial combat training. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Army calls the large-scale training exercise Arctic Anvil. It's designed to test the mettle of the Fort Wainwright Stryker Brigade combat team with realistic scenarios and tough adversaries from other units and allied nations. U.S. Army Alaska spokesman John Pinnell says the biennial exercise requires a lot of preparation and personnel.
Right around 6,000 when you factor in all the soldiers, the support personnel, and everyone involved with the exercise.
This year's Arctic Anvil includes a light infantry unit from Canada and observers with a Japanese tank unit. During the 3 weeks the exercise is underway, the personnel will more than double the population of the area, which includes both Fort Greely and nearby Delta Junction.
It's quite an influx into the Delta area.
The influx will require numerous convoys of Army vehicles transporting soldiers and materiel from Fort Wainwright to the Donnelly Training Area south of Greeley. Pinnell says the convoy traffic will be especially heavy next week and again near the end of October.
The heaviest days will be the first 6 to 7 days of October as the units from the 1st Stryker Brigade move into the Donnelly Training Area. And then again, towards the end of October, between the 21st and the 27th, as they move back to Fort Wainwright.
Pinnell says the Army's been working with the State Department of Transportation to come up with ways to help motorists share the road with clusters of slow-moving Army rigs.
What we're looking at is trying to make sure that the convoys are moving, not during peak hours, when people are going to be commuting back and forth. We are trying to get, a little bit more space in between the convoys.
We'll also be reducing the speed limit between Delta and just south to Donnelly Dome from 65 miles per hour to 55 miles per hour during this exercise.
Transportation Department spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the agency will try to inform motorists about that 16-mile stretch of speed limit reduction and other temporary traffic control measures with signage and online posts.
We have message boards out so that the traveling public sees those messages, and then we'll also have some social media posts about it.
Pinnell says the tempo of Arctic Anvil operations will be heaviest from October 9th through the 20th. He says those will include live fire exercises with artillery and other ordnance. And he says some of the operations will be conducted jointly with aircraft and personnel participating in the next round of Red Flag, which also gets underway next week. That's the latest round of the Pacific Air Force's aerial combat training exercises. That'll involve, this time, units from both Eielson and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. That training will take place in the skies above the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, a 65,000-square-mile patchwork of ranges scattered throughout the interior. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
If you're looking for evidence of climate change in Alaska, here's some. The typical time between Fairbanks' last spring freeze and the first freeze in autumn has increased by a full month in the past century. That fact is courtesy of Rick Toman, a climatologist based in Fairbanks. For the past 5 years, Toman has been something like the voice of climate change in Alaska, measuring new trends against old baselines. This week, he retires after more than 3 decades with the National Weather Service. Toman told Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk that personal memories of climate and weather don't always match the data, so it's important to keep broader context in mind.
We are seeing changes in parts of Alaska and in some seasons that are really quite out of beyond anything that's occurred in not just living memory, but now we can push that past living memory. And I think going forward, as Alaskans make decisions about our future, that context is very important. It's more than just what I happen to remember, and except for those 2 years when I was gone to Hawaii.
Can you talk to me a little bit more when you say about sort of people's memories kind of aligning with what the data tells us happened? Is there anything specific you can point to that helps sort of illustrate that?
People have relatively short, or they base their expectations on relatively short time frames. The classic example is summer 2018 in Anchorage. Many people thought it was unusually cool and rainy, and in fact, it was significantly warmer than the multi-decade average. But it was cooler than some of our recent summers. So it's pretty clear that people aren't judging what's happened this summer from the World Meteorological Organization's 1981 to 2010 normals, which is the standard. They're basing it on the last few years. And it's important to note that's perfectly valid. The problem becomes when the last few years gets projected back into, that's the way it was, so this year was in fact cool. Well, in fact, in the longer term, we can see that this was actually quite a mild summer, but not as mild as some of the recent years.
Are there any other interesting things you take away about how Alaskans are seeing and experiencing climate change?
So I think that in rural Alaska, where most of the communities are fairly strongly subsistence dependent and people are out on the land, there's a general recognition that things are changing. And of course, when you're doing subsistence hunting or gathering, weather and climate is just one part of the equation. How are the times that animals are available? How has that changed? When are plants, if you're berry picking, when are they coming right? Those are all part of the equation. When is the snow melting? When are rivers and lakes freezing so you can get out in the winter time? And that's a very different experience than if you're living in urban Anchorage or Fairbanks and your experience of the change is driving to work. Those are very different experiences. They're equally valid, but they're quite different perceptions, potentially, than, say, a rural subsistence-based community.
Climatologist Rick Tolman retires this week from the National Weather Service. Next week, he starts a new job with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Robin and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Nat Herz in Anchorage, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com. And by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.